And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is the podcast that takes me out of the studio into the study, and I interview some of the most interesting and enlightening people on the planet, and today is no exception. I have an opportunity to interview Andreas Knopp, and he wrote a book called The Last Christians, Stories of Persecution, Flight, and Resilience in the Middle East. I feel we have a little in common in that we're both Scandinavian. I was born in Holland. Andreas is German. And we both wrote about Islam, but his book is a first-hand account that came about in a very, very unusual way. And I want to talk about that in just a few moments. But what's very interesting to me about Andreas is that he was the head of a seminary, and he has chosen to live in a different way today. He is a monastic member of the Little Brothers of the Gospel. This is a group that consciously seeks to live at the margins of society. And I look at some of his poetry. He is a poet as well as a scholastic. And I think of the phrases, the faces of the people are the icons we venerate. And in the countenances marked by suffering, we see the crucified one. Or a couple of other phrases from a poem, no longer harboring illusions of greatness. You humble yourself as human. Only God is great. Adoration now belongs to Him alone. I am so delighted to welcome Andreas Knopp to the Hank Unplugged podcast today, all the way from Germany, and I think it's around 9 o'clock your time, and thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Hank. Here we have just 9 o'clock in the evening. I returned just from the prison where I am accompanying some prisoners, and now I'm very happy that we can meet us by this phone line and discuss and have a good conversation, I hope.
You speak English very, very well. I wish I could speak German as well as you speak English. So,
yes, but my English is very old. I learned English at school that more than 30 years ago, and I never practiced. And so today I took my dictionary for to look for some words. So I hope that we can really have a good conversation.
You know, I want to start this conversation by having you explain a little more about the Little Brothers of the Gospel, as I was talking about in the introduction. I mean, this is a group of people that seeks to live on the margins of society. Why is that? What are you accomplishing?
Yes, this is a very small religious order. Therefore, we also have the name the Little Brothers, because it's a little group. It was inspired by Charles de Foucault. He was a French noble man born in a rich family, and he began a career in the army and later as a geographic explorer of Morocco, of the Sahara. And as a student, he lost the Christian faith of his family. But when he met the praying Muslim people in the Sahara, he wondered about religion. He became a seeker of God, and then he rediscovered the Christian faith. And he wanted to imitate Jesus, and at all, Jesus of Nazareth. So that means for him the Son of God as a poor and simple worker at the margin of society. And he was convinced that God shows his love in Jesus because love always looks for being near to the beloved person. He wants to join the beloved person. So God became a simple carpenter to share the everyday life of the little and poor people. And then Charles de Foucault returned to the Sahara to be a witness to his love of God. He wanted to live nearby a people which never heard something about the gospel of Jesus. So he joined a nomadic tribe in the south of Algeria, the Tuaregs. He himself lived as a Bedouin and became a friend of this nomadic people. And then during the First World War, he was killed accidentally as one of so many innocent victims of every war. So he was the person who inspired the foundation of our little congregation.
And so what's interesting to me is how you became a part of that little congregation. I mean, you were the head of a seminary, and now you've made this incredible transition where you were experiencing the fellowship of the sufferings of Jesus Christ.
Yes, it's true. I studied in Freiburg theology and philosophy, and then I made a doctorate in ethics. And my bishop sent me then to the University of Freiburg, and I loved this commitment because sharing with young people filled me with enthusiasm. But then I discovered that there is missing something in my life. I wanted to share more the life of the poor people. Maybe it was the daily reading of the gospel which inspired me, that was one of the sources. And then when I met the brothers of the gospel, so I discovered the beauty of a simple life. And this is until today something which is attracting me. In our flat here, we have no TV, our community has no car. We are living in a quarter which is marked by poor people. And this presence among women and men at the margin helps us to look for other values, for spiritual values, like brotherhood and solidarity. So I was attracted by this vision of sharing my life with brothers. In our flat, we have no living room but a chapel, because the prayer and the silence is important for our spiritual life. And we try to share also the conditions of our neighbors in working and in a social level. So I worked here in Leipzig as a cleaner or at the conveyor belt. The imitation of Jesus, who lived as a simple worker, helps us to grow in our friendship with Jesus and with the people to whom Jesus felt to be sent in a special way. And these were the people put at the margin of society. So this is a little bit our spiritual idea.
You know, when you think about it, this is a robust form of Christianity. And what I mean by that is that this is real Christianity. So often we are taught about the health and the wealth gospel in the Western world, that if you turn on to Jesus Christ, you can have a palace like the Taj Mahal, you can have a Rolls Royce in your driveway, Christ becoming a means to an end as opposed to Christ being the end. And when I listen to your testimony and to your story, it evokes great emotion within me. I'm thinking about another friend of mine, very similar to you. His name is Father Themi. He was a very famous musician in Australia. Then he went on to get academic degrees, PhDs, and eventually, in the midst of his prosperity, in the midst of his position in life as it continued to grow with influence, he decided to give it all up and to go to one of the poorest places in the world, Sierra Leone, Western Africa. And his life has been dramatically changed because now he has taken on the servant role that you have described. And I suppose, I don't know how you can do this for our audience, but I suppose the thing I'd like most is for you to tell our audience the satisfaction of giving it all up, as it were, so that you can send ahead that which is done, the cup of cold water, the piece of bread in the name of Jesus Christ. You can send it ahead for eternity, where Jesus said, do not labor for that which perishes, but rather labor for that which is eternal.
Yes, we try to live a little bit of that. So our reality also is very mixed. We try to convert ourselves and to to grow with reading the gospel and in sharing. So for us, it's very important also that we are four brothers here, that we are sharing once a week what we are living in our prayer, in our relations, and also in our work. And then we help each other to discover what can you really live from the truth of the gospel. I think the gospel has for every person another truth, because the gospel is always personal. God, the vocation of God means me personally, but in sharing with brothers, so we help to deepen this personal vocation.
Kind of interesting, as you think about where you live right now, one of the great lands of the Reformation, whatever one might think about the Reformation, there's a whole history there. It's often romanticized, but nonetheless, you live in a country that was once the epitome of Christianity, and today it's largely secularized, and oftentimes Christianity is seen to be the enemy, and the mantra prevails that Islam is a religion of peace and tolerance, and Christianity is a crusader religion. Talk about that whipsaw, that transition from a country that espoused the Christian faith to one that now denigrates it.
Yes, I'm just living in the east of Germany, and there is a long story of secularization. It was also the experience that the Christians between themselves were in war. They had the war of 30 years. And so I think this experience that Christians are fighting against Christians in the name of their religion, that destroyed the roots of the faith in the gospel. And so we have to rediscover that the Christian faith cannot be preached and lived with violence. Jesus chose the way of nonviolence. He preferred to be a victim of violence, and he didn't take a sword in his hand. But in the time, in the course of the centuries, this was forgotten because there was the temptation of political power. And so in Germany, and at all in the east of Germany, a lot of people just since centuries lost their faith in the gospel. And so in Leipzig, we have 90% people without religion. They are no Muslims, no Christians, no Buddhists. And when you ask them, they say, oh, I'm nothing. I am not religious. Religion for me is not interesting. That doesn't say, tell me nothing. And so it's important for us as little brothers of the gospel just to be present in this ambience of people who lost the faith in God and in Jesus.
It sounds a little bit to me like you're talking about the fusion of Christians, the answer to Christ's high priestly prayer that they all might be as one. And if there is a solidarity amongst Christians around the essentials of the Christian faith, then we have a power to share with the world that is not there when we are fractured, when we experience fission.
Yes, I think that would be very necessary today, because it was just the aim of Jesus, just his prayer for the unity between the Christians, a unity which respects the difference, because there are different languages, cultures, traditions. We have to respect them. And I think that if we want really to live the gospel today, we have to live in a very large and free ecumenical spirit. So we have to discover that all the confessions, all the different Christian confessions bring a rich spiritual, theological, and cultural tradition with them. And we see this also with our brothers of the Orient. The Christians of the Orient, they also bring their own tradition, but they always respected the different Christian confessions. They never had a war, one confession against the other, like we had in Europe. And so we lost our credibility. And the Christian faith can also be credible for the world of today when they live these rich traditions in unity, but respecting the differences. And I think also in front of the Islam, when we Christians, we are not accepting each other, how we can be a witness to the Islam when we are just not bearing witness to the unity of the faith and of the different churches.
It sounds like you're talking about what C.S. Lewis referred to, and it wasn't original with him, of course, but he wrote a book called Mere Christianity. That phrase, mere Christianity, often sum up in essentials unity, non-essentials liberty, and in all things charity. And in just expanding on that just a little bit, Andreas, I'm thinking about sometimes in the West, Western evangelicals do not seem to care a whole lot about the plight of Christians in the Middle East who are facing mass genocide. And oftentimes it is because they perceive those Christians as being Orthodox Christians, Coptic Christians, Christians that they think are worshiping a dead liturgy, and therefore they're not Christians at all. And so there's this separation, there's this unnatural bifurcation within the Christian faith because we don't recognize the richness of traditions other than our own.
Yes, I think there's a very important point that you are mentioning now, Hank. I think the Western Christianity, they also neglected to know something about the Eastern Christianity. So they were only proud of their own tradition, or they wanted to dominate the Eastern churches. That was just a problem of the Roman Catholic Church. I'm Roman Catholic, but the popes in some centuries, they wanted to dominate also the Eastern Church and not to recognize their own richness of tradition, spirituality, liturgy. They wanted to make Latin all the Christian world. And that was a big, big mistake. And today we have to recognize that we didn't take enough care to see our brothers and sisters in the Orient, and so they got victims of genocide, of extermination, of being pulled out of their countries, because we didn't see them and with really eyes of brothers and sisters.
You know, it's interesting, you sort of underscored this, but as an academic, though you're living the life of Christ through the expression of the little brothers, as an academic, I think you might realize better than most that the West has this snarling logicality. In other words, we have to explain everything in complicated fashion, whereas Eastern Christians oftentimes leave those things that we can apprehend but not comprehend in the land of mystery. So, for example, we say about the Trinity, we apprehend it, we can't comprehend it. About the incarnation, it's something that we believe, Christ, one person with two natures, but that's incomprehensible to us. The Eucharist is another example. Or the Mass, this becomes something that we believe is the real presence of Christ. And yet, in the East, this is not explained. It is rightly, I think, left in the realm of the Mysterium Tremendum et Fascinans.
Yes, I think they kept more the respect that so we cannot understand the mystery of God. And important is not to understand with the head, but to live it with your hands. So to live the example of Christ in everyday life, to live solidarity and brotherhood, and not to understand God with conceptions and ideas that maybe was important for to distinguish, but nobody is converted to Christianity by reading the dogmatic book, but by seeing a Christian living today in sharing his life with the poor people, or to be engaged for freedom, for the creation, for fighting for justice. This is the point where people are discovering Christian faith.
Maybe you can expand on that a little bit. I think this is really interesting for people listening in to understand the difference about what you communicated as intellectual knowledge, knowing about God, and then knowing God, the difference between knowing and knowing.
Very
in
good.
Other words,
very good.
Yeah, so you have.
That's the important distinction. Yes.
Yeah, you have experienced Christ by becoming a servant of Jesus Christ, by emulating the way of Christ. And perhaps you can explain, as very few can, what it means for Christ to become more real than the flesh upon your own bones, because you're living the way of Christ.
So for me and for my brothers, it's the first thing to read and to read and to read the gospel. So in the hope that our soul will be transformed. So to feel like Christ, to know the inner spirit of Christ, and to learn to see with the eyes of Christ, to learn to hear with the ears of Christ. So that I think this is the important thing, that this is an inner movement, to know Christ more and more. And then in your everyday life, you will discover what would be now the decision of Christ, his action, how he would react in a certain situation, if you have this inner feeling of him.
You are involved with what we would call the ascetic practices of the church. Oftentimes talk about this as the spiritual gymnasium. In other words, you're involved in prayer. You're involved in almsgiving. You're involved in those graces by which we can attain union with God or fellowship within the Trinity. Talk about the significance of real Christianity through that spiritual gymnasium.
Oh, that is a long theme, but I think one thing is to be faithful to prayer and to reading the gospel. We need also a rhythm, so not to let go, let it be, but really to be faithful every day, to find a certain form in which you are nearby to the person which loves you. God loves us in Jesus Christ. And so it becomes an inner wish. I want to be near to him. I want to answer to the gift of his love. But this every relationship needs a certain regularity. And this may be, this is the ascetic. Ascetic may mean really to be faithful to a certain rhythm and to certain exercises. And then nobody can be a Christian alone. Christianity, you can only live in sharing with the sisters and with brothers. So we need the community. We need people who are true with us, who help us to see our own difficulties, our own where we are injured, where we have problems, so that they are true with us. And that helps us to be true with ourselves and true with God. So the community is very important.
Yeah, I think you've...
Yes?
No, I was just going to say, sorry to interrupt you, but I was going to say that that is such a salient point to make to the Christian community, because there's so much rugged individualism within Christianity. And as you've correctly pointed out, Christianity is not a Lone Ranger endeavor. It is a communal existence. I mean, when you're baptized, you're baptized into a community of faith. When you take communion, you do that in community. We do the work of Christ not in isolation, but we do it, as Romans 12 makes clear, we do it as a community of faith.
Yes, that's just very important. And everybody can live this in his own way and fashion. So I am living with three brothers of the same congregation. Others are living in families, or they look in a parish for groups, or they have a prayer group, or they have a group of sharing, a group of solidarity with refugees. But we need this experience of being brothers and sisters.
Yes, and you know, when you talk about the experience of being brothers and sisters, I want to kind of segue into your book, The Last Christians, an extraordinary book. The first thing I want to say is that you are an extraordinary writer. I've almost written 30 books now, so I know a little bit about writing, and your book is just riveting. But I think what makes it riveting is that you had a dramatic change of direction that was precipitated by the funeral of a friend of yours. And so God took you on an unexpected journey. You saw the persecution of Christians firsthand, and rather than turn a blind eye to it, have it just be a momentary experience, it really changed your life.
Yes, that's true. But the first change was just when the refugees arrived in our quarter. We are living in a quarter which is was constructed in the communist times. So these are blocks of flats, very gray and simple. And a lot of flats are empty. Here now where I'm speaking, five flats above me are empty. So it's also a very sad situation. But 3 years ago, the first refugees came in our quarter. And there I discovered also there are Christians among the refugees. For me, this was a new thing. There are coming Christians which speak Aramaic, the language of Jesus, until to today. They celebrate the liturgy in Aramaic. They pray Our Father in Aramaic. So I heard for the first time in my life like how Jesus spoke the words of the Our Father in the original way. And I was very astonished, and then I got friend of these new neighbors. And through these new neighbors, I discovered the rich history of the Christians in Orient. And I could, 2 years ago, I could accompany one of these men to the north of the Iraq. His father died, and he wanted to go to the funeral to pray for him. And he asked me, do you come with me? And I said, okay, I come with you. And that was really like, that was not expected how fast we could organize this journey. Because from one day to the other to go to the north of Iraq with all the papers, but all was prepared. I think it was the hand of God who prepared that. And so I could make this journey. And I saw the refugee camps, and I participated at the liturgies. I spoke with a lot of Christians who lost all their goods, who were expelled from Mosul, from Karakosh, from the old Christian cities there. And I met the architect of some churches, and all churches were destroyed by the Islamic State. So that was very I was very touched by these meetings. And this was the reason why I reflected these stories, they have to be written down. We shouldn't forget the stories of persecution of these Christians. Now they are in Europe, in USA, in Australia, in New Zealand, but they bring with them very rich history, and we have to help them to preserve this history.
Can you give us a little sense of why you titled your book The Last Christians? Whenever I read that title, it's indicative to me of the fact that mass genocide is taking place, but we're largely unaware of it. It seems very similar to what happened at the turn of the century with the Armenians. You had mass genocide against the Armenians, and most people, when you talk to them about it, if you tell them what happened in the city of Smyrna, where it was manifestly destroyed, they look at you like you're talking a different language. They simply know nothing about it. They remember the Holocaust, but they don't remember the genocide against the Armenians. They don't remember what happened in Asia Minor. So whenever I see this title of your book, it's haunting to me. The Last Christians, mass genocide taking place. The stories, however, to me, are encouraging in some ways, because in an odd way, you think back to the first century and you see the blood of the martyrs becoming the seed of the church.
Yes. So that is also my hope, that all the suffering of these Christians was not in vain, but that can help us to rediscover our own roots, to rediscover the truth of the gospel. So The Last Christians, I choose this title for my book because it's true that the Syriac Church, the Church of the Orthodox Syrian Christians, they have still the Aramaic as the language of their liturgy, and there were existing some villages and even a town which spoke Aramaic. But now all is destroyed. 2 years ago, they all had to leave their homelands. And now this original church with the language of Jesus doesn't exist anymore in the place of the Iraq or in Syria. There rest some small communities, but 2 or 3 years ago, it was still a big community. And now they are the last Christians speaking the Aramaic, but not only the language, but also to be very near to the gospel with their lives, for their witness, for their faithfulness, for their way of reading the gospel as a message of love of God, of the mercy of God, and which was never read in a way to be violent. They always were very faithful to the non-violence of Jesus. And so it's, for me, very hard to see that these communities are destroyed. The last Christians had to go from their homelands, where they were enrooted for 2,000 years. But as you told just now, I have also the hope that when we see them, when we listen to their stories, when we read their history, so that can inspirate our own faith, that can help us to live more faithful to the gospel, and to live this hope that to be a victim as the martyrs, that is not the end. But that can be a new beginning. The end of Jesus at the cross was just the moment where God recreated the world. That was a beginning of a new world, of another world. And so I also hope for these refugees and for me and for our Western churches, when we listen to this message they bring to us, that we also can read the gospel in a new and deeper way.
Beautiful. I almost don't know what to say. So the last Christians, the title of your book, I want to expand on this a little bit, because in the West, I hear a lot of people talking about the fact that ISIS is being crushed, and therefore the Christians in the Middle East can return to their churches, that all is well in Syria and Iraq and other places where mass genocide has been committed against Christians. Give us a sense of what reality is today. I mean, you've already sort of alluded to it, but give us a sense of how that moniker, the last Christians, is still true. The Christians are facing tremendous persecution. The fact that ISIS is being crushed or might be crushed does not mean that suddenly persecution against Christians is going to cease.
Yes, in a certain way, this cruel state now is becoming weaker and weaker. But there are ideologies, and there is a fundamentalistic Islam which was preached for a long time and supported by Western governments, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and this poison is still present. So you can win a war by weapons against the state, but an ideology you cannot destroy by weapons. It is necessary to elaborate another way, which means education and culture. And so these countries need another education, another culture in which is appreciated the liberty of religion, the equality of men and women, democratic values. This cannot be brought by weapons. You cannot convert a country to democratic values by weapons and by an army, but this has to be an inner process. And there I see that the Western world, for a lot of time until to today, is supporting non-democratic states in the Middle East. And so I don't see for the moment that is really another way growing there where Christians can live with liberty and with liberty of religion and being sure of their lives and being respected. And the tolerance in this moment, I don't see where this tolerance is really lived. So I think it will be a long way, but it's not a way by weapons, but by education and by culture.
That's beautiful. You know, in Islam, there's a very, very different worldview than the Christian worldview, in that Jesus Christ said, "Given to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, unto God the things that are God's." And in that, he pointed to the separation between church and state. If you look at Islam, you don't have that separation. Sharia is state, state is Sharia. And as a result of that, it seems to me that it is an ill-founded idea to try to force democracy into places like Iraq without doing the very thing you allude to. First, the hearts of people have to be changed before you can have that change of culture as well.
Yes, and I think this is a big problem for Islam, as you just said, because in Islam, just from the beginning, there was this mixture from politics and religion. Muhammad was a spiritual person, a religious leader, and at the same time, it was a statesman and a warrior. And so this confusion rested through the long time of Islamic history. But I see today there are Islamic teachers and intellectuals who are thinking in another way, because in the revelation of Muhammad, there were two different times. The first time in Mecca, where Muhammad was a spiritual leader in also preaching tolerance and respect. And then In the second time of Medina, he was more a political leader. And in the long time of Islam, the Quran was read with a key of understanding that Islam is politics and religion at the same time. In Christianity, we have another history, because Jesus never was a political leader. He didn't want to be the king with the sword in the hand. He didn't. This was one of the temptations in the desert for Jesus. And he resisted to this temptation. I don't want to bring the gospel by force, by political force. And so Islam has to learn that. And this is a good development that there are intellectuals who are thinking this way, but it's only a small group. And I think that we as Christians, we have to help them and to support these groups of Islamic teachers who are preaching another way of reading Quran, this another key of understanding which separates political power and spiritual life. And only if this idea can be accepted by Islamic states, then there will be the possibility of a liberty of religion, of conscience, of tolerance and respect. For the moment, I am very skeptical whether this will be a political future in the next time. But we have not to lose our hope. As Christians, we have always to have hope for the better world of God. And so we have to support this good movements, and we have to stop. We have finally to stop to support the fundamentalistic interpretations and the states who are paying them and who are working in the direction of a fundamentalistic Islam like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others.
Interesting. As you point out, there really are two Muhammads, and there really, in effect, are two Qurans. You have the Meccan Muhammad, and you have the Medinan Muhammad. You have the Meccan surahs and ayahs, and then you have the Medinan surahs and ayahs. And the two are very, very different. The problem, as I see it, is that the Muslims have a doctrine of abrogation, which means that which went before is abrogated by that which comes later. And unfortunately, the most violent verses are those that are the latest or the last verses of the Quran, not in terms of the chronology of the Quran, because that's not how the Quran is organized. It's organized from the longest to the shortest. But in terms of the last pronouncements of Muhammad, they were very violent pronouncements. But I think that what you're looking forward to is a couple of things. One is that people will gravitate to those verses that came out of Mecca rather than the violent verses that came out of Medina. And then the greater issue, and that is, as you change Muslim hearts, you change Muslim behavior.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the only hope that we have, that another interpretation of the Quran can help the Muslims to discover the values which we got from the gospel. Maybe it will take a lot of time, but I think that we have to support these intellectual teachers who read the Quran with another interpretation. But I'm not sure whether they will really have success. And what you told, we cannot cannot change behavior without changing the hearts. And I think if the Muslims and now the refugees discover in our society that people are not discriminated because they are Muslims or Christians or Buddhists or not believers, so if they discover that as a real value, So they can change. They can change. Say, okay, this is the better alternative. So if they discover what the Western society is living here, with freedom, tolerance, respect, equality, this is better. This is a better ethical alternative. So we can win them from their inner side, from their heart.
What I'd like to do is take a little journey into the pages of your book. In your book, you recount the story of how in 2006, a Syrian Orthodox priest was abducted by Muslim extremists. And then the condition of his release was that the church should disown a speech given by Pope Benedict the 16th. Well, the relatives distanced themselves from the Pope's words. They paid the jizya or they paid the ransom, and yet the priest's arms and legs were cut off. The brutality that you describe in the book is unthinkable to many people. They can imagine this in a horror movie, but they can't imagine that this is going on as we're eating in fancy restaurants.
Yes, I was also shocked in reading this story when they told me in Iraq. I think human violence and cruel behavior is a very complex phenomenon. As a German, I know the history of the terrible violence committed by the Nazism of Hitler. And I think that ideology and also religion can activate these cruel potentials to whom people are able. Ideology means for me that an idea becomes so strong that the normal human feelings and commitments are eliminated. And also, religion can serve as an ideology. It can activate feelings like hate, anger, and fear. And I think the problem in the Arabic Muslim world, so pride is a very important feeling. And when the Pope criticized the Prophet Muhammad, a lot of Muslims felt being hurt. It was like an attack to their identity. They had the impression as if the Pope wanted to aggress their religious and social identity. And I think this impression led to a very highly emotional reaction. They wanted to avenge this aggression, and they used the Christians in their neighborhood as scapegoats. And I think this is an archaic mechanism which can produce a very cruel behavior towards innocent people. So this is also a problem of the culture of the of being pride and also to think that religion has to be defended by violence. And in Christianity, we have another message. So you cannot avenge God by killing a man. Man cannot be killed only because you for the honor of God. Because this was the motive, the honor of God. Mm. But in Christianity, we knew that Christ was killed. And the high priest thought it was in the honor of God. But then, by the Christianity discovered, no, never a man can be killed to honor God.
I want to get into a number of other issues, but back into your book, you talk about the spray painting of Christian houses with the scarlet noon, the 14th letter of the Arabic alphabet. And so you have these houses that are being confiscated for ISIS and then declared free for looting. And talk a little bit about this noon, this 14th letter of the Arabic alphabet. We ourselves at the Christian Research Institute are producing these pins. I wear one on my lapel as a way of standing in solidarity with Christians in the Middle East that are facing genocide, opening the discussion about it. For me, that 14th letter of the Arabic alphabet, that noon, is a term of solidarity. I stand with the Nazarene, with Jesus Christ. For Muslims, spray painting that noon on houses is like a scarlet letter. It is like a term of derision. And I think you talk about this in the book because this is not just something academic to you. You've seen it.
Yes, I myself have a T-shirt with the Arabic letter of Noon. And if I remember well, it was a Christian TV moderator in Lebanon who began wearing shirts marked with this letter to show, it was a woman, her solidarity with the Christians of Mosul. And at the same time, I remember that also during the Nazism in Germany, some Christians put on their clothes the Star of David, which the Nazis used to mark and discriminate the Jewish people. So they wanted to show their solidarity with Jewish people. I think that could really be a very good sign of solidarity with the Christians, which have to suffer only because they are believing in Christ.
One other thing that occurs to me that I want to get your perspective on before we get further into your book, I think about assimilation of Muslims into Western culture. And I've often talked about the problem of migration without assimilation. And if you live in an EU country, as you do, you're probably more aware on a visceral level what that means, migration without assimilation. And perhaps what I'm getting at is how can that problem be solved? How can the problem of these Muslim enclaves in which Sharia law is being practiced, how can you take that kind of a motif and change it so that Muslims more readily assimilate into the German culture or the Swiss culture or the Dutch culture or whatever it might be?
You touch a real problem because I think for most Islamic or a lot of Islamic people, there is also this identity between religion and society or being member of a state. And so they wanted to remain faithful to their religion. And for example, our Turkish minorities here, they wanted also to remain Turkish people. So the assimilation or the integration in the society is very difficult. And I think this is a problem connected to Islam because there is no separation between religious life and social life or to being a member of a faith or a religion and be a citizen. And I think it should be developed also in Islam, the notion of citizenship. The citizenship means that all citizens of Germany are equal and they have the right to vote and so on. But this is not connected to their religion. But the people who are coming now from the Arabic countries, they don't know this distinction. They are thinking, yes, I am a Muslim and therefore I cannot share the citizenship to be a German. So they have to learn to distinguish. I can be a German and I can vote in Germany and have all the rights and duties of German society, but in the same time, this is not connected to my religion. I hope that they discover here that citizenship is a progress. It was a very important human progress to discover the notion of citizenship, because they don't bring this with their experience, but they have to learn that. And that is a long way. It's a very long way. And I hope we have patience and we can convince them that they can integrate in our society, being here, German citizens, and at the same time they can remain Muslims in respecting that a Muslim has the same rights as a Christian and as a Jewish and as a not-believer, and that the Muslim is not a prior or not a, there's no superiority of the Muslims in front of the other religions. This is a heritage they bring with them. this idea of superiority, but they have to leave that.
There's a demographic problem as well, I think, that probably you are more aware of than most. In the Western EU countries, you have basically the death rate far exceeding the birth rate. And so in many ways, Europeans are self-aborting through abortion, through euthanasia, through same-sex sexuality, and many other reasons demographically why the native populations are dwindling. And then you have polygamous Muslims rushing in to fill the vacuum. So the patience that you talk about, yeah, on the one hand, you need to have that patience. On the other hand, you do have a very severe demographic problem. And I think I mentioned this earlier, but it seems to me that a country that becomes Muslim demographically will be a country that becomes Islamic politically as well.
Yes. So I see the same problem as you mentioned it. I see the same problem. But I hope, on the other side, that living here in our society and learning about our values can also convert the opinions and the hearts of a lot of the Muslim people. Not of all, but I see that there are a lot of who are really appreciating our society with the values. And so they leave this idea that only Islam is the true religion and there has to be a connection, a very near connection between state and religion. So they discover that the secular society or a citizenship offers a lot of liberty. And I think liberty and freedom is something which is attracting people. And there may be, that's my small hope, that this that the ideas grow faster and the convictions grow faster than the demographic process.
Well, what's going on in Turkey? Not a single church has been built in Turkey since, I think, back in 1923. The remaining churches are being taken over by the state. And it seems very, very strange to me, because if you think about what happened March 3rd, I think it was 1924, when Mustafa Kemal Atatürk abolished the caliphate and he pronounced the Islamic religion as the theology of an immoral Arab. He said it was a dead thing and produced a secular state. Now you have Erdogan seemingly turning everything into sort of a hard line and returning the idea of Islamization back to Turkey.
Yes, the Atatürk tried to convert Turkey in a modern country, but that was not possible from one moment to the other, and there were a lot of regions which rested very traditional in their faith, in their political thinking. And in Turkey today, there are two different movements. And one movement is really to have a modern Turkey with a democratic and tolerant state. But in the last years, there was growing this the Islamization of politics. And I think it was also is a problem of power, because the Atatürk time, this was always protected by military, even by the generals. And so Erdogan, he was very very smart. He took democracy to get to the power, to arrive at the power, but he is not convinced of the democracy. It is only a way to arrive at his aim, the Islamization of the Turkish society. And so I think we have a real problem with Turkey. There are some movements which are really fighting for liberty of press and opinion and religion, but a lot of them, they are now in prison.
It's a stunning situation, and you think about the whole of the Levant from Anatolia or the southern part of Turkey all the way down to Egypt. It's a place in chaos and turmoil, and it deserves the prayers of all God's people. And not only the prayers, but the active functioning of God's people. A lot of my friends in the West that are part of an organization or a move of the Holy Spirit called the Lord's Recovery are actually traveling to and migrating, as it were, to places like Germany so that they can reach out to people who are refugees with the sole purpose of bringing the gospel, doing the sorts of things that you are doing, the cup of water, the piece of bread in the name of the Lord. I want to touch on something else with you, and that is the stunning contrast between the concept of martyrdom in Christianity and the concept of martyrdom in Islam. For Christians, martyr means witness, a person who suffers violent death for Christ's sake as a blood witness. On the other hand, in Islam, a martyr is defined very, very differently. He's someone that carries a weapon, he dies as a holy warrior, and for Islamic authorities to describe, therefore, suicide attacks in which the perpetrators go straight to paradise and the victims go straight to hell seems nothing short of perverse. Why do these radically different notions of martyrdom, why are they so different, number one? Talk about that. But what do they tell us about the values that underlie Christianity as opposed to Islam? And is there even a conceivable way that such radically different values can be reconciled?
Yes, I think the difference in understanding martyr tells us something about the basic difference of Christianity and Islam in their origin. So the central person for Christianity is Jesus, and he preached and lived nonviolence. He preferred to be a victim of unjust violence. And Jesus gives the example of a Christian martyr. And his example tells us also something about the Christian image and understanding of God. God doesn't force man to believe. He respects the liberty of man. In Islam, it's quite different, because Muhammad, as just we told, was also a statesman. And therefore, the Islamic martyr is somebody who bear witness to his faith also by fighting with weapons and killing people. In this concept of religion, God can be seen as a force who forces man to believe, because the not believers are threatened to be killed. So here we find really a great difference between the two religions. But there are also elements of interpretation we can reconcile these two opposite directions. I think reading the Quran with in every surah there is the beginning, in the name of God, the most merciful. You can also read the Quran with this keyword. But in the tradition of Islam, it was not read in this direction, mostly. But they know also the martyr as somebody who is not suffering violence, but who is killing other people. There's a real difference between the two religions.
There is, and your book is absolutely incredible. It is riveting. It is well written. And I want to mention to our audience that the book is available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. For those who support the ministry, we'll just send a copy out to you. You can check it out on our website at equip.org. The Last Christians by Andreas Knopp. And these are stories of persecution, flight, and resilience in the Middle East. The picture on the book, to me, is a very riveting picture. And I'm sure there's a story behind why this particular picture is on the cover of the book.
Yes, it shows a woman praying. And at the same time, you see a tattoo on her hand with a cross, with a sign of Christ. So I think you see a suffering person, and at the same time, she's bearing witness to the cross of Jesus. So she discovers there the suffering, the own suffering, is connected with the suffering of Christ. And this gives also the force to live this very difficult experience with faith and with hope.
I think about the writing of a book, and as I write my own books, there's always something big that stands out for me. There's this big idea, or there's this big truth that underscores why I wrote the book. If you were to summarize your book as a word or an idea or a moniker or concept that is the big idea, what would that be?
So I think I was very happy to learn from the Christians from the Orient. And I was very touched by their faithfulness. A bishop in Iraq told me they have all lost, but they didn't lose their faith. And I was very touched by this sentence. So for me, the idea is, or the main idea and the treasure is that we can learn from these Christians how to be faithful also in a difficult situation, to be a witness to love and to nonviolence, and so to be faithful followers of Jesus. The Christians of the Orient remember us that in the beginning of Christianity, there was a man in whom people could recognize the presence of God because he was the witness of love, and he preached reconciliation and peace. The Oriental Christians remained very faithful to this origin. And they invite me and invite us to rediscover the gospel of love and peace.
Talk to self-satisfied Western Christians. Oftentimes we sit or stand in beautiful auditoriums. We have prosperity. We have all the luxuries of this world, and yet there's a God-shaped vacuum that only He can fill. And I think you can speak to this probably better than most, because you're living the life, as it were, of poverty. You're living a life in which you've given up the things of the world, but you've gained something far, far richer, far, far more fulfilling. And I think if Christians could emulate that in mass, we could as yet be a global, world-changing power. But we've lost the power of the gospel because Christ has become a means to our ends.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I made the experience that following Jesus in everyday life, this can fulfill my heart more than all the consumism and a lot of things. They are only troubling my spirit. But living in a simple way, sharing with the poor people, I go to prison to visit the prisoners, to share with them, that makes my life very rich. And this was Jesus was preaching and living. He went to the people at the margin of the society. And there you can discover that God is very near to you.
I am so touched by your book, and I'm so touched by the opportunity to speak to you. The authenticity of your Christian testimony is very evident in your words, and I'm grateful for you. I hope a lot of people will get the book, and more than that, a lot of people will emulate the example that you have set forth, not only in the broadcast, but in your everyday life. So thank you so much. I mean, this has been far richer than I ever anticipated. I mean, the book was phenomenal, but talking to you exceeded my wildest expectations.
Oh, thank you very much, Hank. And also to listen to your testimony and to your witness and to your answers, that was very rich for me. So if somebody puts good questions, we can always learn more. Thank you for the conversation.
I'm hoping someday I'll get to meet you in the flesh. I mean, I'm battling cancer right now, and you know, when I get done with this battle and it looks promising, I hope someday I'll see you.
Okay. You're invited to come to our quarter here in Leipzig in Germany, and there can you present some of the families of the Christians who are the refugees and who are very beautiful people, and I learn a lot of by them.
Well, thank you, my brother. This was a fantastic time for me. I know the people that are going to be listening in over the months and years to come are going to be very blessed by your testimony and, of course, by your book. Thank you again. I'm deeply grateful to you. And by the way, for those listening into the Hank Unplugged podcast, you can go to iTunes and leave a review. You can share. This is one of those treasures we can share with the world. Let people know. Again, by going to iTunes, leave a review. Of course, you can listen to this podcast wherever you consume your favorite podcasts. Another edition of Hank Unplugged. They just keep getting better. And I want to close by just asking people who love Jesus Christ to pray for Andreas Knopp. He's an example to me and to many others of what it means to take up your cross and daily follow Christ. Thank you so much for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. I'm looking forward to the next edition with great anticipation. God bless.